Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus. Nate Mavis is your other host. And our guest today is Leo Wolpert, whom, Nate, you've known since high school.
Yes, we have known each other since high school. And he was awesome then, he's awesome now, and I'm looking forward to talking to him.
Yeah, this is going to be one of those shows where we just have a good conversation with a good conversationalist and someone we both know pretty well, someone who's an interesting character to talk through. The one thing that doesn't come across maybe real clearly on the interview that I think is an important bit of information for people to have about Leo is, his username when he's commenting on my blog is Emo Meltdown, and he's got a little bit of a neurotic self-critical streak.
Yeah, that's got to be right. It's definitely one of those interviews that aims indirectly to answer the question of what people's poker lives are like and what their lives as a poker player are in future. So there will be some Las Vegas lifestyle in there. There will be some strategy of, you know, how to game select and how to grind it out day in and day out. And yeah, in Leo's case, a lot of that is also that part of what's made him really good at poker is a very self-critical mindset that it seems also causes him a certain amount of pain. So
yeah, and we don't talk a lot about that real explicitly with him, but I think it's there, you know, if you listen a little bit between the lines, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if you do a forum search for on 2+2 for stuff that Leo's written, or
that's right. Yeah. Superfluous Man is his screen name, which I thought was just a clever screen name. But Nate, I think you told me that's actually a character from Russian literature.
Yeah, I think it's a Turgenev character. I haven't read the relevant thing, so I couldn't tell you more than that. But I know he's a fan of Russian literature. Actually, to the listeners out there, Andrew and I have made a $1 bet on what Leo's favorite book is. Andrew has all Russian novels, and I have The Field. So we'll ask Leo what his favorite book is when he gets on the show here. So
I don't remember off the top of my head what his Full Tilt screen name was, but it was also a character from Russian literature. So I'm feeling good about my side of the bet.
Yeah. I can't remember either, unfortunately. I do remember yours. It was your Urban DB 888, or is that a secret?
No. That's information.
Yeah, I can let that cat out of the bag now.
Which actually, I used to get a lot of. Well, I mean, you tend to see a lot of racist talk in online poker chat boxes anyway.
Yes.
But I did feel like I was getting an odd amount of racist chat directed at me, and I always played on Full Tilt with the avatars turned off just because I found them kind of distracting and it was easier to multi-table with them turned off, in my opinion. So I didn't generally have the avatars turned on. I didn't know what my avatar was. But as Nate mentioned, my screen name was UrbanDB888, which was for Urban Debate, an organization and a cause I used to be pretty involved with. But I think a lot of people saw the Urban and they saw my avatar, which was in fact the black guy with the big afro. And that was prompting a lot of people to call me some pretty nasty things in the chat box. So I did eventually change my avatar in part for that reason.
Interesting and very, very sad.
Yeah. I don't know if it's better or worse that, I mean, because plenty of people were also calling me a Jew, which I don't think there was any indication. I'm not Jewish, and I don't think there was any indication from my screen name or my avatar that I was. So I think it doesn't seem like people really need a reason to be racist, although I guess I did give them a little encouragement.
That's pretty strange. I never got any racist abuse on either PokerStars or Full Tilt.
Well, mostly people direct that at you when you win.
Oh.
It's not even true, really. I'm pretty sure I have been trash talked when I've lost pots before.
Yeah, no, I can confirm that that I get abused both when winning and losing.
Leo was also good enough to stick around and talk strategy with us. He brought in a few hands from the recent Heartland Poker Tour event at the Palms. So you'll get to hear a little bit about Leo's take on tournament poker strategy as well.
It's one thing that's interesting is that some of these hands take place under conditions that I know I don't have a ton of experience in. I mean, I've played a lot of live tournaments, but a lot of them are big events that I've been traveling in from out of town for, and that featured other people who traveled in from out of town, and it's just a different mix of people. I haven't really ever been in a position where I was grinding out like 1K, 2K, 3K events in Las Vegas with largely locals and regs and grinders and people like that.
Yeah, it probably is a little more similar to playing like a $100 rebuy on Full Tilt rather than play, or you know, on any online poker site, as opposed to playing like a $10 MTT that's drawing several hundred participants.
Yeah, yeah,
I think that's thousand, I guess, for the $10 tourney. Hey, Leah.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hey, great, doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I just finished eating a bite of Pop-Tart, so...
Nice. What flavor?
Cherry, actually. Yeah, a lot of people really prefer that brown sugar cinnamon one, but that one really, I don't know, it's too cloying. I need that sugar in a fruit kind of flavor. And cherry just kind of hits the spot.
Okay. Well, to each his own.
So the suspense is killing me. We've got a $1 bet on this.
Oh, I haven't even introduced him yet.
I don't know. I thought that was like the best possible introduction. I think we should just run with it now.
All right, go for it.
I agree. Nothing like a good old free advertisement for Pop-Tarts.
We can't do better than the Pop-Tart intro. So
true. I'd also like to add that I'm drinking a refreshing Coke Zero.
Very good. Bottle or can?
It's a can.
All right.
And I'm also drinking from an Arrowhead water bottle, but I've refilled it numerous times from my fridge, so I can't say it's actual Arrowhead water anymore.
I see.
Oh, which I mean, it was probably hose water to begin with, but...
Okay, so Las Vegas tap water, Arrowhead water bottle, cherry Pop-Tart, Coke Zero out of a can.
That's correct.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And
Breakfast of Champions at 1 in the afternoon.
All right. And you have to settle our $1 bet now. What's your favorite book?
Okay. Wow, my favorite book of all time.
Yeah.
I hope one of you put money on. This is a difficult question, and it'll be too difficult for me to decide.
No, that's a push.
Well, this could be heavily influenced by recency bias or something like that. But I just literally this morning finished reading Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, yes, which actually I got from your blog, Nate.
Excellent.
And it's an amazing book with just so many ready applications to poker that are just waiting to be sussed out and applied, certainly to my thought process in my game in general, but everybody else's. And I was actually a little hesitant to recommend this book because I feel like people have a lot to gain, but
Christ.
You know, I can't really be too concerned about that because there's plenty of coaching out there, and yet somehow people still find ways to make mistakes at poker despite all of it. So I'm not particularly concerned that people will read this book and magically overcome all their biases and start to just whoop my ass at poker.
Yeah, I can't say enough about how good that book is. And now it's also won me $1 because Andrew had all Russian novels and I had the field. So
wow.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about my favorite book is that it changes with great frequency. So ask me this question next week, and if I manage to read an entire book between now and then, you could win that dollar back.
Yeah. What are you reading now that you finished Fast and Slow?
I have not even decided yet because I was actually thinking about preparing for this interview because I didn't want to come across as dimwitted. And instead, I just sat in bed and resigned myself to finish this book. And, you know, it was very rewarding. But next up on the list, I went to the library yesterday, actually. It was like a 20-mile bike ride, round trip, which is by far the longest I've continuously ridden a bike. I rode it to a library that's basically across the railroad tracks of Henderson, so to speak. And I literally did cross railroad tracks to get there, so it's not totally inaccurate. And they didn't even have the book I wanted. I wanted to get a book written by Jonathan Duhamel. Really? He apparently wrote a book that I had no idea about until I typed the word poker into the Henderson Public Library search, and it was one of the first results.
Yeah, and I had no idea he wrote a book.
Yeah, it piqued my curiosity because I had ideas, oh, maybe I'll start a blog and, you know, started out with a book review of a book that I've literally never heard of. But so I rode the bike, you know, it was supposed to be a 16-mile trip. I made several wrong turns and turned it into a 20-plus-mile trip. And when I got there, they didn't even have it. So I ended up getting a collection of David Foster Wallace short stories,
yes,
which should please Nate very much.
And myself. We're both big fans.
Yeah, you're both huge Wallace fans. I've actually made various halting attempts, aborted attempts to read Infinite Jest, and maybe one day I'll take another crack at it. But I'm going to start with more of the short stories. Yeah, and I also picked up a Vonnegut collection, which I probably read. I probably read like three or four of the pieces in the collection, but you know, the other three are new to me. So,
so which collection of Wallace stories did you get?
I think it was Oblivion, but I'm not sure. I can go reach over to my backpack and pull it out.
There's that. There's brief interviews with Hideous Men, and there is. Shoot, let me look over at my bookshelf here.
It is Oblivion.
Yeah, it's good.
I was gonna say, if it wasn't Oblivion, we should pass on to Leo the traveling copy of Oblivion.
Yeah, it's I wound up with two copies of it, so I gave one to Andrew.
And I don't really read paper books, so I'm still only like halfway through it.
Yeah,
just because I'm always on Kindle.
I found Kindle a little bit of a mixed blessing. I don't have an actual Kindle. I just use the iPhone app.
No, it's worthless. The nice thing about Kindle is the non-backlit screen. Reading a Kindle on anything other than a Kindle is a waste of time.
Wait. Really? I think it's not so much the physical discomfort, although that's a bit of a factor. It's more of the constant barrage of distractions that a phone is capable of giving me.
Yeah, well, a Kindle too doesn't do that.
Wants to, you know, make the next move in a game of letterpress. I mean, all sorts of things can pop up and just wrench my mind right out of the book that I'm reading.
It's interesting. I've read a million books on the Kindle app for the iPad, and I love it.
I think there's something to be said for that. For actually having a Kindle and having big letters, or an iPad as opposed to an iPhone, to read books on. But still, the biggest factor is by far the distractions.
Yeah. Anyway, so we should get you back on the show after you've read Oblivion, or some fraction of Oblivion, or you've thrown it across the room in disgust after five pages, like some people do. So.
Short stories, I feel like I'm a much better handle on than novels.
Yeah, I mean, Oblivion is definitely late and weird compared to some of his earlier stuff, and...
I don't know, Hideous Men is pretty weird, too.
Yeah,
I think I've read a couple stories from Hideous Men. I used to amuse myself by going to the bookstore and, just reading books for free.
Just stealing readings.
Right, then deciding after 2 hours of sitting around the UVA bookstore being like, I guess I probably won't buy this, and why didn't I go to a library first? I probably could have done that. I'm looking forward to it.
Good.
What is a library like in Las Vegas? I get the sense that that's maybe one of the least literate cities in the country in terms not in terms of people's ability to read, but in terms of number of books consumed.
Well, to be fair, I've only taken maybe three or four visits, and I've only been to two libraries, both of which are in Henderson. Mm-hmm. And what I've seen, my general impression is that it is geared toward retirees and the elderly in general. The keyboards for their computers are gigantic, those gigantic yellow keyboards with the awkward yellow keys.
Wonderful.
And a lot of large print books. I'd say it's much like a library anywhere else. It's has books, has people reading the books. I didn't really notice a whole lot of difference from this and any other public library. It's certainly different from a university library, or definitely a law library. There certainly weren't tomes of like law reviews and law journals just sitting around waiting for over-eager students to kind of pour over and... find something for their next paper. But overall, I don't think it didn't give me an impression of illiteracy, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Okay, one more sort of quick question before we just start discussing things in detail. Since you won your bracelet, how many times have you worn it after that day?
Zero. I am not a wristwear guy. I don't even wear a watch. I feel like when I wear something on my wrist, it kind of highlights how... I don't know, absurdly skinny they are. And also, I think wearing a bracelet is kind of a little off-putting and ostentatious.
Maybe a little.
Gauche, perhaps.
Yes, that's a good word for it. I think it's nice to kind of stay on the down low about poker accomplishments at the table.
Yeah.
And kind of give the impression that I know what I'm doing, but not... throw it in people's faces or give people reasons to really play back at me or be creative against me at the table. I want people playing predictably, obviously. And I think wearing a bracelet kind of, especially at the table, encourages people to take shots at me, or, you know, anybody else is wearing one or anything like that.
So you're a grinding pro now, right? And what other sorts of, I don't want to call them soft skills, but what else do you do as you try to grind it out in Las Vegas? So, I mean, you talked about trying to create a certain kind of image. Like, what else do you do toward those ends?
I think one of the biggest things I do in terms of metagame is quitting. Like Tommy Angelo says, making a good quit is one of the most valuable things you can do as a cash game player. I think being aware of how good the game you're in and being objective about it, or at least trying to be objective, if reading Thinking Fast and Slow has taught me anything, it's that kind of objectivity is kind of impossible to get to. But just be realistic about why I'm in the game. Is there a reason I'm going to be winning money in this game, or that I stand to win money in this game? And if there isn't, you know, I can just get up and go home and, you know, ruminate on my session or do any number of things that don't involve breaking even or losing. I mean, for instance, yesterday, last night, I went and played a session at Bellagio, and it was good for a little while, and all of a sudden, there are just two regs to my left who are just better than the average Bellagio regs. I think, you know, guys who are just going to play back at me and put me in difficult spots. And then my phone ran out of batteries, so I was like, might as well quit.
Do you game select between casinos, or do you just show up at the Bellagio and sit down at the 510, or do you game select within the Bellagio, or do you even sort of look for other casinos also?
I kind of game select by casino, I think, first and foremost, and it might be just a kind of artifact of sampling size, but I feel like Aria regs, perhaps because of the higher cap on the buy-in, are way more aggressive, way trickier, and way more apt to put me in difficult spots than Bellagio regs. And that's no knock on Bellagio regs. There are lots of people who, you know, play well and make money in Bellagio games, but I think it's just I adjust better to them than I do to Aria regs. But I mean, it, like I said before, it could easily just be sample size where I, you know, played a few sessions at Aria, ran bad over, you know, a couple hundred hands, and now it's just imprinted in my memory where it's like, play at Aria, you're gonna lose.
Right. Do you ever look at non-hold'em games?
I branched out into PLO. I try to stick to big bet games because while I kind of came up playing a little limit hold'em, I never really felt like I was that great at it.
Yeah, it's a different mindset.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I actually live with a couple, you know, limit game grinders who are also, you know, good at big bet games, but they make their living at limit games, and I just it's tough for me to fathom playing those games, or at least without a ton of work. I wouldn't want to even venture into, say, 10-20 limit hold'em, because I just would have no chance of being profitable without hours of study and you know, perfecting some sort of thought process that, you know, varies differently or varies wildly from my no limit thought process. So yeah, I've branched out into PLO a little bit, especially at Charlestown, West Virginia, when I was at my parents' house. Oh, it's a good room. They had a half 5-5 PLO game and half 5-10 no limit game. And I'm no PLO expert for sure, but playing in that game, I felt like one. I felt Galfond in playing in that game. You know, I was just doing stuff like I folded the second nuts at some point and was right. I guess that's not that big an accomplishment in PLO.
When you fold the nuts, right, that's a PLO accomplishment.
It was flop second set. So right. on a rainbow board with only one straight draw.
Yeah.
And I got cold 3-bet and folded.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I was also fortunate in that there was a very loose player in the hand who got to showdown against the cold 3-better, and he had the top set, thankfully. Of course, the coda to the story is that the river was the case jack that gave me quads.
Ooh.
Wah. Results oriented. Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah. So you talked about living with some limit grinders. I was under the impression you live with some sports bettors too. Is that true?
Oh, well, my roommates right now, my housemates are Brendan Taylor, aka Card Sharp Cook on 2+2.
Oh, nice.
Oh, really?
And he plays a lot of the limit games at Bellagio, the high stakes mixed games, the 80-160s, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about him the other day. He was like one of those. I wonder what ever happened to.
Oh, he's still here. He's still grinding.
Nice.
And also Scotty Abrams, who Weird Chess won on 2+2.
Okay.
And he got 12th in the main event this year. You may remember him from getting in with the King Jack of Diamonds versus Jesse Sylvia's set on Jack something something diamond board.
Yes.
Could have been King something something.
Yes. I thought it was Jack High, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, there was a good
I mean,
about
I was
that
there, and I'm wrong about it. So I guess that goes to tell you something about the fallibility of memory.
Yeah, meta rationality has been a big theme of this podcast so far, but go on.
And that's certainly one of the things I find so enjoyable about it is because there aren't many discussions of meta rationality in life generally, much less in poker.
Yeah, yeah.
In poker, it applies so readily and it is so useful, and I'm kind of surprised that there aren't more.
I mean, have you incorporated non-poker advantage play into your gambling life, like? Do you take advantage of any of those lots promotions or rebate promotions or anything like that, or a good sports bet occasionally?
I feel like I don't have the requisite knowledge to bet sports profitably. When I do bet sports, it's almost always low stakes and for pure entertainment, you know, like something like, oh, I know I'm going to be watching this Monday Night Football game, but I don't really care about either team. So I'll just, you know, put $20 on one team. So I have a reason to root for one over the other. That said, I do think there are some kind of soft bets, but it's usually not me who's finding them. It's usually somebody else who recommends them to me. And because I trust this person's knowledge of sports betting, then I put down the money. But it's certainly not me personally doing any of the research or, building models or doing any of that stuff, or, you know, chasing steam or whatever actual pro sports bettors do. I'm not actually doing any of that. So I wouldn't say I'm an advantage gambler at sports. And the closest I've come to slot promos, I'd say, is Station Casinos has had a promo where, I think they have it going on right now as well, where if you play 50 hours during a specified time period, 50 hours of poker, you qualify for a free roll where first is something like 20,000 up top. And about this time last year, I was much worse off financially, and I was considering getting a job. And it was also about the time I was about to study for the bar exam. So what I did is I said, okay, I'm not going to play higher than 2.5, and I'm only going to play at Station's Casino so I can qualify for this free roll. And instead of doing something foolish like playing the PCA and starting out the year stuck, you know, 20,000 or whatever, and having a negative start to the year, I'm just going to play the Station's free roll. That'll be the last poker I play till the bar exam's over. And, you know, then I can go from there. It's actually qualified for the free roll. I made day 2 of the free roll somehow. It's about the worst structured thing ever, but, you know, you get what you pay for. And yeah, won like $200. So instead of being stuck tons from PCO, it was up 200. And I guess that, you know, is a nice way to start the year. Oh, another big thing about this year was another former roommate of mine, Ben Yu, Professor Ben. He was living with us for most of the year up through the World Series of Poker, and then he moved to Mexico to grind on Poker Stars. And he was also very big into sports betting, especially college basketball. So, you know, moving overseas seemed like a much easier decision for him. Well, overseas, over borders, more like it.
Yeah.
But he also won the Red Rock 1K, and that started off my year, because I had 15% of him in that. That started off my year with a nice, maybe it was 10%. Regardless, it was 20%, regardless of it. It was just a stark contrast to my year this year, not going to PCA and actually winning money in free rolls and in buying pieces and, you know, winning money without playing poker. That kind of, I don't know, set the tone for this year, a tone of confidence. Though, of course, this could also be fallacious reasoning, and I could just be conjuring up a narrative that exists only in my head.
So you talked about considering getting a job. Do you have an exit strategy from poker now, or, I mean, short or long term?
I absolutely do not. It is very much up in the air. I've so many qualms about practicing law and about getting a job where I'd have to be accountable to some sort of boss who isn't me. That just kind of scares me. It gives me the fantods. And from what little experience I've had doing actual legal work, it's a kind of anxiety that I sometimes feel in poker, but it's much more prolonged over a long period of time. Like, for example, if I have a deadline coming up for some sort of motion that I'm supposed to write, it just hangs over my head for hours upon hours. Even if it's, 3 days out and I know I can do it, it's just a prolonged panic of, wow, this isn't good enough. I could reword this argument. I could find better sources. I could find better cases to cite. Always comparing myself against some sort of ideal that doesn't exist, some sort of, Atticus Finch, I'm going to save this client, even though his case is completely untenable and he's guilty as sin. That kind of thing just weighs on me really heavily when I'm trying to do the nuts and bolts of legal practice. But I feel like I do have a lot of options open to me. I just have no idea which path to take.
And it doesn't sound like you have a lot of inclination to take them either. You're not in any rush.
That is true. I do feel like I have plenty of time.
Do you regret going to law school? I mean, do you feel like it was a waste of time if you're not if you're now not really envying a legal career?
Oh, well, regret is kind of an odd way to put it. I think if you asked me this question at this point last year, I would say, yes, slam dunk, 100% regret it. Oh my God, worst mistake of my life. Now with a year of, I guess, moderate poker success between now and then, it's the regrets have somewhat dissipated. I certainly don't think it's a positive ROI investment. And it's certainly, given that I don't really have a big interest in practicing law, at least the kind of legal practice that would make a lot of money, fighting for high paying clients is not my ideal. I think my ideal would be, to fight for principals, but right, principals don't pay much. I seem to have lost my train of thought, but
were you thinking like you get enough money saved up from poker that you can afford to be principled?
Yeah, I was thinking that, but I think a big thing about law school was that it did hurt my poker game to a large extent, trying to balance the demands of law school with the demands of poker. Yeah. There just isn't enough time in the day to do all the reading and then do all the, prepare for exams adequately, because let's face it, exams in law school are what matter. And if you can kind of game the system and be the best at studying for these particular kinds of exams, you will excel at law school and you will get those job offers. I mean, assuming that your school is elite enough, and go into a whole signaling model rant, a huge piece of evidence in favor of the signaling model of education, where the value of your diploma is entirely based on showing how smart you are, how conformist you are, how diligent you are, and not what you learn in law school. Because if you get a high GPA in law school, it really doesn't matter, at least from what I've heard and what I couldn't say I've experienced it, but from what I perceive, it doesn't matter if you got those A's in black letter law courses that are going to be directly applicable to your practice, or if you got them in law and literature, or law and, or the Lochner era, a historical study of early 20th century law, or early 20th century economic precedent in the Supreme Court. It's not going to matter. What matters is that number and the institution you went to, because I think that's what determines what gets the jobs. So, I mean, in contrast to, say, the human capital model, where the value of an education consists mainly in what you learn and how you can apply it to different jobs. Sure, you learn stuff in law school about how to be a lawyer, but it's certainly not not mandatory.
Yeah, I used to, when I was first living in Boston, and I wasn't even really yet a professional poker player at this point, but I was starting to take the game more seriously, and my my best friend and my roommate from college was going to Harvard Law School, and he started up a poker game with a bunch of the other Harvard Law kids. And I mean, I know that there were kids at that school who were working very hard, but the ones in our poker game definitely were not. I mean, they were getting through, and I think most of them probably have pretty high paying jobs now. I guess a lot of that just has to do with the Harvard name. I don't know to what extent they were, you know, very good test takers or something, but.
Well, I think most people who get into Harvard Law School are just good test takers in general. You have to take the LSAT to get in. You have to score highly. And from what I hear, Harvard values LSAT scores more than they value GPA. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a bit more of an aside. But back to the question of regretting going to law school. I mean, I made great friends there, met great people there. And it was an enjoyable experience, to be sure. But I'm not sure it was worth the sticker price.
Yeah.
I would be happy to transition into strategy talk now if you're okay with that.
Wait, can we talk about Jeopardy first?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just rip my heart out a little bit. Or we could talk to losing that D2 ICT to Nate's team back in the day.
Yeah, I once defeated. Yeah. Oh man, I, unlike you, I tend to leave that in my past. I mean, not out of
person. Oh, what? That was the shining moment, dude.
I mean, it was. It was the highlight of my Quiz Bowl career, probably. Yeah, it's just, I mean, not out of shame. It just feels like a totally different era. It was just, I gave up Quiz Bowl for poker sort of immediately and completely and haven't really thought about it since.
Oh, my transition was much, much slower from Quiz Bowl to poker, much slower. And let's see, I still feel very nostalgic about Quiz Bowl, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there have to be so many reasons, but, you know, it's just a great game for me particularly. It kind of allowed me access to so many different subjects, academic and otherwise, that, but for Quiz Bowl, I would never have even thought to get access to. I mean, I certainly would never have gotten into literature or economics or psychology without Quiz Bowl. And Quiz Bowl, you know, writing Quiz Bowl questions, answering Quiz Bowl questions, studying for Quiz Bowl, breaking down things in individual clues, kind of at least gives me a jumping off point for whatever kind of field I want to study or want to learn more about. I can just kind of recall, oh, this is the big name from, I don't know, from econ.
Sure.
And say, okay, I can jump into this person's work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Have at least the most superficial fraudulent knowledge, at least having that fraudulent knowledge kind of allows me an entry point into more robust.
It gives you an idea of where to start and what might be interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned breaking things down into clues. I mean, when I think about Quiz Bowl at all, which is rarely, what I'm most grateful for is I think it made me a much better writer, just because you have to write so clearly and break things down and pay so much attention to how your sentences sound and how sort of and like where information is coming from and like the effect on the listener. And I think it's actually some of the best writing training I've gotten. So
you guys are going to have Absolutely. To enlighten a noob here, because I thought in Quiz Bowl you were answering questions. What is it that you're writing?
The questions that other people are answering.
Yes. There are certain types of tournaments called packet submission tournaments, where the participants, the teams who are participating, they write questions, and then during the round, they have a bye during the rounds in which their questions are read, obviously. Mm. But it saves the effort, or it saves a lot of effort on the part of, say,
the organizers.
They don't have to have one individual just crank out hundreds of questions. They can have a few individuals edit tons of questions, which often means completely rewriting them wholesale, as I learned in my handful of editing experiences.
So like, what's the incentive to you to write a good question? Like, I mean, Nate's talking about being really diligent about trying to word things well. Like, does that affect you at all, or is that just like an ethic?
Social norms.
It's certainly, I think the norms of the quiz bowl world have a ton to do with it. You don't want to be a person who gets known for writing shitty questions. Because I think the quiz bowl world, you know, can be full of mockery. And the people who do the mocking are often pretty smart. The quiz bowl doesn't attract too many imbeciles.
Yeah.
So they can be quick-witted and harsh with the criticism.
So yeah, what makes it good? The
norms is really important. And over so many dimensions. There's so many ways you can violate these norms. Like, oh, this one clue is old. Or this one phrase you used could lead to multiple answers, and it traps the player into guessing incorrectly. There are all sorts of ways you can screw up writing a quiz bowl question.
What would make a quiz bowl question good?
Okay, so there's a concept called pyramidality. You want to kind of envision your question as a pyramid, with the most obscure clues. This is just for one type of question, by the way, the toss-up, which is the one that anybody and either team can buzz in on. Mm. So you want to have it structured so that the most obscure clues that reward the greatest depth of knowledge are at the very beginning of the question, and then you kind of gradually make it so that there are less and less obscure clues as the question goes on, and it culminates.
So people can like ring in sooner. Like if they get one of the more obscure clues, they can ring in before the person has finished reading the whole question.
Exactly. So it would reward, you know, say if you've read a novel and there's the first, or say there's a question on a novel, and some of the earlier clues are just very obscure, picayune details from this novel. Maybe like the eighth most important character or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then it gradually goes, you know, further and further into something, you know, maybe some sort of vague plot description that would still get somebody who has at least, you know, read the novel to buzz in there, or somebody who has, you know, at least heard of the novel. And then at the end, it's a quote unquote giveaway clue where anybody with any sort of superficial knowledge will get the question. You know, for instance, the giveaway clue would be for 10 points. Of course, for 10 points is a signal saying that the end of the question is forthcoming. For 10 points, name this novel about a white whale by Herman Melville.
Right.
And, yeah, then at that point, if you're playing a quiz bowl tournament, you should probably buzz in and say Moby Dick.
I don't know. I think Melville should come before white whale, though, in that last bit. So
that's a good point. I'm already violating the norms.
I don't know. It's a subtle point, I think.
Well, we hear a lot about people coming into poker through chess, backgammon, Magic the Gathering. Is there like a whole underworld of former quiz bowl players in the poker world? And you two are just the only two that I know of.
I'm going to say I would qualify that with yes, because I can think of at least one other person who had success at like mid to high stakes, no limit. And I'm sure there are other people who came in and out of the poker world and might still be in there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wonder if Nate could guess who I'm even thinking of.
I can think of one. Should I out him on air? Is
his initials FB?
Yes.
Okay, we're thinking of the same person.
Yes, that's the only one I can think of. I do, I mean, just through Facebook and so on, I hear of poker people quiz bowl people trying poker. Often it doesn't go very well, but I think probably, like, if I had to back either a chess player or, like, I would probably take a bridge player over a chess player and a chess player over a quiz bowl player, however smart so many quiz bowl players are. Like a top one percentile memories are very valuable in poker, but probably not as valuable as being elite in the skills that would make you an elite bridge player. I don't know. Would you agree with that, Leo?
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with you. And I think I'd also extend that to chess as well. There's kind of an aspect of long-term planning that exists, I guess, in chess, and I'm not so familiar with either chess or bridge, but certainly not bridge, in that you have to think about, you know, what your reaction is going to be if somebody does something else. You have to take your opponents into account. And in Quiz Bowl, there really isn't that dynamic. You do kind of have to make small adjustments for your opponents, in that maybe in certain categories of questions, if you know you're up against a super elite literature player, you might want to take more aggressive guesses on literature questions, because there's a lot of value in stealing that from that person, or getting that one question in that person's specialty. And if you happen to guess wrong, well, at least you took your shot and they were going to get it anyway. But other than that, I don't think there are many opponent dependent things in Quiz Bowl, where there are just so many more in chess and bridge, and certainly in poker. I think poker, one of the biggest leaks in my game that I find is that I often don't plan out, or plan out for contingencies, and get myself kind of caught in sticky situations where I kind of have to rely on guessing, and guessing all too often is influenced by emotions or other, you know, biased intuitions that can lead to just completely incorrect decisions.
Right. So chess lets you avoid some of the meta-rational traps that you and I both fall into sometimes.
Is Jeopardy more or less a direct extension of Quiz Bowl? I mean, does it feel like playing the same game, or were there some strategic differences?
There are definitely strategic differences, in that Quiz Bowl is so much less about timing than Jeopardy is. Jeopardy, for those who do not know, you cannot buzz in until Alex is done reading the question. And you know he's done reading the question because a ring of lights comes on around the board that signifies when you're allowed to buzz in. And if you buzz in before that, you get locked out for a second, i.e. an eternity, and which allows other people to buzz in. So the problem is, if you wait to actually see this light, nobody has fast enough reflexes to just see the light, mash the button, and buzz in. What the best do, what the Ken Jenningses of the world did, is mastered anticipating when the light would come on, basically a beat or two, a half second, however long you want to quantify a beat. That was when you had to buzz in, a beat after Alex had finished reading the question. And of course, I love to use this as an excuse for why I lost so badly. I mean, Ken Jennings obviously knew more stuff than me and had a better recall of it, certainly at the time. And this was when I lost to him in 2004. I was near the peak of my Quiz Bowl abilities too. So I would love to think it had a lot to do with him having dozens of episodes to practice that timing. But, you know, he had to win the first few of them against reigning champs as well. So he, you know, must have been really good at the timing from the outset.
Yeah, I do think that's funny. I mean, he's obviously a extremely intelligent guy, but the extent to which he's gotten this reputation as being like a super genius, and that people think of Jeopardy as being a show about, you know, primarily about how much you know. If it turns out that at least among relatively intelligent people, the biggest skill is how quickly you can buzz in, rather than, you know, your ability to recall slightly more obscure information than someone else.
Oh, absolutely. I think, I used to kind of poo-poo the strategic notions of Jeopardy, and I think they're actually way more important than most people are willing to admit, particularly because once you get on the show, once you've passed the written test and done all that stuff, you know 95% of the answers to the questions. It's just getting there faster. And I think as Brad Rutter showed, the strategy is crucial. I mean, he didn't crush by, you know, just knowing more. He crushed by taking a strategy of going all in when he got the daily doubles, because he realized that he was very likely to know the answer for any given daily double. He would just go all in and double up and then just build insurmountable leads. I think that's kind of a stroke of genius.
Is there a place where all this stuff is discussed? Like when you realize, okay, I'm going to be on Jeopardy, is there a place for you to go to like learn this stuff, or did you only learn that after the fact?
Well, to learn what kind of stuff, like the strategic aspects?
I mean, to learn, for instance, the timing of buzzing in. I mean, do you know ahead of time that that's going to be important, or did you learn that in retrospect?
I knew it was going to be important, in that I think I'd read some blogs or memoirs of people who had gone through the Jeopardy experience and talked about this exact thing. But at the time, I kind of resigned myself to the notion that I wouldn't be able to practice this buzzer timing anyway. Like, I would watch episodes of Jeopardy and then mash a ballpoint pen. But honestly, without being in the situation, I don't see how that could help very much.
Yeah, and you're not getting feedback as to whether you actually got it at the right time or not.
Exactly. It was just, you know, something to keep my hands occupied, more or less.
So my Jeopardy story, and this is kind of a tenuous connection to my uncle, really, but I had an uncle who was on Jeopardy, and the guy that he lost to had won the previous day under, I guess, what would count as a bad beat in the world of Jeopardy. His the final Jeopardy, it came down to final Jeopardy, and the final Jeopardy question was something about an inert gas, and the answer is helium. So his this guy,
guess
what's that?
That is quite the inert gas.
is thinking for a long time, and then just before time is about to be up to writing to submit his answer, he realizes the answer is helium, and he starts writing, and he writes an H, he writes an E, and just the very slightest beginnings of an L, like a tiny line, and time is up. Aww. So if he had had time to finish writing the L, he would have lost. But because HE is the chemical abbreviation for helium, or yeah, the symbol for helium, he was it counted as a valid score, and he won. Wow. And then went on to defeat my uncle the next day.
That's pretty brutal. I mean, I wonder how much of the L he got. Did it look like he was trying to say, oh, it's helium 5 or something? Welcome back. Wait, aren't you supposed to say that?
Welcome back, Leo. How's it going?
It's going just as well as it was 3 minutes ago.
So I freshened up my tea, and Leo has a charming observation about the tea at the Bellagio.
Oh, yes. It is radioactive in the way that the mutagen from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is radioactive green. It's not literally radioactive, I hope. Just the color.
Well, you're still alive, so it's some evidence that it's not.
I'll take it.
Yeah, you there, Andrew?
Hello.
Hello, Andrew?
I did not hear Andrew.
All right, no Andrew. We're flying solo here for the time being.
I'm sorry. Right. My microphone was turned off.
Oh, no, it's
cool. Was muted.
I was going to stall for time telling the story of the now-deceased grinder who would save a dollar whenever he could by conveniently being in the bathroom when his drink arrived at the table.
Oh, wow. That is way too much effort to save a dollar.
Especially because you don't even have to tip. Like.
Yeah, well, I mean, it, like,
I guess people, you didn't want to look cheap.
Oh, but you do have to deal with the opprobrium of not tipping.
Yeah, although, like, everybody knew what he was doing. It's not clear that he harbored any, that, like, the waitresses got any less pissed at him or were any less likely to mess with his drinks.
Right.
Oh, yeah, but he didn't have this.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, maybe he imagined that he was hiding something from someone, but I imagine it was not really, he was not really pulling anything off.
You got the slight thrill of thinking he was getting over on somebody.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Why you really want to, you know, get over on a waitress who's, you know, making probably not that much money doing a demanding job of serving drinks is beyond me.
I'm sure whatever your guess would be for a Bellagio cocktail waitress, I would take the over if you think it's not very much.
Sure. I mean, I've actually, in some of the downtime poker, kind of thought about this and thought about whether or not, you know, certainly my more brutal sessions or my more brutal confidence downswings, I've given thought to, hey, could I make more money as a waiter ratio? And so I try to think about, you know, how much they're making in tips and how much they have to kick back to the people who actually make the drinks. And I guess depending on how well I'm playing, the answer could still be yes or no.
Yeah. Anyhow, given that stalling for time was actually not necessary, let's hear about those hands that you wanted to talk about, Leo.
All right, so I recently played the Heartland Poker Tour Palms event.
Okay.
It was like a 1650 buy-in, And I'd actually played in April and got fourth, so I had to insert that little brag in there.
Nice.
And this time, I fired two bullets, one on day 1A, one on day 1B, and made it to the next to last level both times before not making further levels. And one of these hands, I guess I don't know how many hands we're going to discuss, but the first of these hands comes from late on day 1A. The blinds are 600, 1200 with a 100 chip ante. I had just recently come to the table, and I had about, I want to say, 75K in chips, so 60-something big blinds. And both of the relevant people in this hand have me covered, but not by very much. They probably both have, I would say, in the 80 to 85,000 range of chips. So a youngish woman, I kind of recognize her as being regular, and in my two orbits of the table, she's made very regular-ish opening sizes and c-bets. She opens to 2600 under the gun, and another woman who I'm friends with, she flats in middle position. I look down at the king of clubs and the queen of spades, and I'm next to act in, I guess, one before the hijack, and I make it 8600.
What was the open raise size again?
26.
The open was to 2600.
Okay.
And there's a flat in middle position. Mm-hmm. I'm next to act, I think, either in the hijack or one before the hijack, and I make it 8600 with, again, the king of clubs and the queen of spades. The opener, she asks how much I'm playing. I show her my stack, and she calls. And the other woman folds. So now there is 22,500 in the pot, and the flop is queen, six, deuce, rainbow with one club. I think it was the queen of clubs. The opener checks, and I decide to check it back.
I like that.
Yeah, standard. I mean, I can see reasons not to, but it's got to be the standard play.
I think it's somewhat standard. I didn't debate it long at the time. It just kind of felt right,
yeah.
But it was one of those situations where I wish I could articulate better, or, you know, access the kind of black box of my poker logic, so to speak, or my poker intuition, to kind of suss out why I did that as opposed to betting, because I think a lot of people would really default to betting here. But I think at the time, I had a kind of a concern that if I got it in here, if I bet and I faced more, and I faced a raise, I would hate it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, one reason I can think of to bet is that I could imagine situations like in tournaments that I've played where I could actually be comfortable bet folding. So it doesn't always feel great to re-raise when you might be light, and then to bet fold once you hit top pair. And there could be other reasons to bet. But other than that, I don't see this as a great hand either to bet call or bet fold with.
Yeah, I don't really see a lot of reason to. Well, the main reason I see for checking is that I without some sort of dynamic, I don't really see you trying to get all in with this hand, or trying to go even three streets with it in a three bet pot. It doesn't seem like it would be all that likely that she would call you down three times with lesser hands.
Right. I did not think I would get three streets from jacks through eights.
Right. So I mean, maybe like queen jack suited is about the, or like something like that would be about the only hand that she might hold that you'd be able to go three streets against. And in general, if three streets go in, you're not going to be in good shape. So that's, I think, the first thing you should think of when you flop like a pretty good hand is exactly how much value is this going to be worth. And I tend to think of that in terms of streets. So am I going to get three streets out of this, or two, or one? And if the answer is less than three, then, you know, the next question you have to ask is, okay, so which two streets? I think the answer in your case will probably be two. It'll depend a little on what happens, but most likely you can get two streets from this. Yeah. And then the question is which two. Well, I think when you get, oh, sorry, go ahead, Nate.
I was going to say there are only two pot size bets left, but but I guess the bets are not likely to be pot-sized for the pairs. Yeah. So.
Going back to preflop, I feel like I often just fold this hand preflop, and maybe I'm just a nit, but when I see an under the gun open in a flat, I would generally just kind of be scared and not think that. Well, certainly I don't think that king queen is going to be in good shape when one of them continues.
Yeah. I would standardly fold this unless I had good control over my opponents, when I would then think about calling. But but you had reasons for three betting.
A big factor in my three bet was that the flatter is actually a friend of mine who I don't know exactly how she plays, but she's not a pro, and she I thought was flatting probably a little wider than she should. While I had been at the table in the couple orbits that I'd been at the table, I had seen her flat an ace three suited and get to showdown. So I figured that she could still A, be flatting wide, and B, not want to play a pot out of position against me. So I kind of saw her flat as, a little over two BBs of deadish money in the pot, and now I have had much more incentive to go after it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I felt calling was out of the question, because I think there were certainly aggro players behind me who would be somewhat likely to squeeze, or at least flat, and then I'm stuck playing king-queen out of position in a multi-way pot and not having really any idea what's going on.
Sounds good.
All right. So I check back the flop, and the turn is the six of clubs, putting two clubs out there. The opener bets 9,100 into 22.5K, and I call.
Sounds good.
I think that's pretty standard.
Yeah.
I think I just don't see what a raise accomplishes, and certainly did not check back this flop planning to fold to a less than half pot bet.
Yes.
Or an over bet probably even as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would be pretty damn exploitable to fold to any bet on the turn. Oh, yeah. Just to say you would never do it, but it would. You'd need a pretty good reason.
Yeah, that reason was not present. So the river is a red three. I don't remember if it was the three of hearts or the three of diamonds, but that's irrelevant. She checks fairly quickly, and I decide to bet. And I bet 18,300 into, 41K or so. 41.7?
Yep.
Or 40.7, something like that. You can just call it 40K. 41K.
Yeah.
And she jams within, I would say, 15 seconds for 32K more effective.
Ouch.
And it's for pretty much all but her last 10 K, or her last 10 BBs, and it's for my tournament life.
Wow.
And I definitely, in retrospect, I don't like my sizing, but I would love to hear your guys' thoughts on why exactly the sizing was bad, and see if it matches why I think it was suboptimal.
Boy, I don't have a ton of experience in three-bet pots, sort of with this kind of dynamic in tournaments. I would rather hear Andrew's thoughts first if he's got smart things to say. I've got a few things to say, but I bet Andrew's things to say are smarter. So that's it.
So I would say if I don't consider this an easy fold, then I don't like checking the flop as much, because checking the flop is more or less announcing that you don't have a hand that you want to play for stacks. And I think against a lot of people, that's a relatively safe thing to say, either because they won't realize it or because they won't act on it by taking exactly this line. But it is a dangerous thing to do against someone who can take this line, you think, with a well-balanced range, because I think you are somewhat capping your range by checking the flop.
I agree to a certain extent, but I also, at the time, I justified it a little bit by saying, well, I guess I could check back queens here. Our top set here.
I was thinking that too, but that's not really enough. You know, like considering that you're equally uncomfortable here. Well, I don't know if you are. Are you equally uncomfortable here with aces? Probably not.
I don't feel exactly good about aces here, because really the hands of the margins that she could be check raise shoving that I now beat are with aces as opposed to king queen, or what, ace queen and kings exactly.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry as much about her having aces, which here, I mean, I don't know how likely she'd be to 4-bet that pre, but...
I certainly don't think I have to worry that much about her in kings, obviously because I have one, and also because I think if she's going to flat huge hands to a 3-bet, I think she's going to flat aces more than she's going to flat kings, especially with a person who, although I don't think either of us expected the flatter to overcall, I think that is more of a possible, that would probably cross her mind more if she had kings, and she would want to 4-bet them more than if she had aces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would also feel pretty awful getting check raised here with aces. I would not feel very good about calling off my tournament.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, just the fact that you could have queens in your checking range then isn't really nearly enough to balance, like, all the times that you have one pair hands, you know, anywhere from king queen up to aces. Like, you're not going to have better hands than that all that often. I mean, I guess I don't know to what extent a hand like 7-6 suited would be in your range as a light 3-better that you would then check the flop with. It doesn't seem that likely to me.
I think I'd probably bet with 7-6, but I guess I could check it back. But I think I'm less likely to check back a 7-6 just because I am much happier to get a fold from somebody when I bet the 7-6 than when I bet the king queen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, and you have to 3-bet in the first place, but that's
true. Well, I did make a few other light squeezes in this tournament, but they were certainly in spots where they were different from this one.
I'm wondering how she could have expected you to bet the river, and therefore if she expected you to bet the river. I think your hand looks like maybe a medium pair. I mean, does that make sense? I guess a lot of those wouldn't 3-bet before the flop. I thought maybe like a small pair that you didn't feel comfortable calling with before the flop, you might choose to re-raise.
I think I'm pretty comfortable calling those small pairs pre-flop because I can just...
You're that deep.
I would expect kind of like a cascade of calls behind me and maybe an occasional squeeze. But I think pocket players play plenty well set mining in those kind of spots.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just doing the obvious exercise of trying to read your hand. Yeah.
I mean, it could also be like jacks or tens or something. Like, yeah. I feel like Leo's range is pretty clearly split. Like, I think he could easily have and easily be perceived to have both hands a little weaker than a pair of queens and hands a little stronger than a pair of queens.
Yeah.
You know, like certainly from like tens through aces, you know, including like king, queen, and ace, queen in there. And then, you know, maybe occasionally something a little weaker than that. So, I mean, that range is probably a little more likely to bet the turn than to check. Like, I would imagine, I mean, even jacks, I think you can value bet the river if checked to, unless you're concerned about a check raise like this happening with something close to optimal frequency.
These kind of river check raises are just so rare in tournaments.
Yeah,
that,
exactly. Yeah.
It really kind of sent me into the tank for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, you've essentially done everything up to this point exploitably.
Absolutely.
With the expectation that you're not going to be exploited by exactly this move very often. And presumably that's because you think people are going for value when they do this and that they don't have too much of a bluffing range, which I mean, with all the rest of those assumptions, just leans me towards a fold here.
Yeah. I think Leo's hand looks to be about the strength that it is. And I, for pretty much exactly that reason, I would fold and not feel great about it, but.
I mean, I was also getting over 3-1 on the river to call it off, which kind of weighed heavily in my thinking as I was trying to kind of furiously count up and conjure up hands that she could be bluffing with.
Yeah.
You know, missed clubs, maybe. But, you know, which combos of missed clubs? Is she turning, you know, it would be crazy to turn, like, nines into a bluff here. But
yeah,
seems, I mean, if she didn't read my hand for what it is, then it seems like it could be a pretty good plan.
Yeah. Maybe some hand with the ace of clubs in it. Ace-X of clubs. Well, I guess exactly. Well, no, the queen's a club, and you have the king of clubs, so... Like exactly ace jack of clubs or something like that. Yeah, but would she call that before the flop? I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, there's a ton of good hands for her to check shove here. Like check shoving is a great play on her part, because it's extremely likely that you have, like, virtually your entire range is very uncomfortable when she does this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the reason that's true is because you've done all these other things throughout the hand to make clear that you have pretty much exactly the hand that you have, or you have a type of hand that's not substantially different than the hand that you have, and you've done all those things presumably on the assumption that she's not going to take advantage of this great opportunity to check raise bluff you on the river. So, I mean, if you're going to go back and re-examine that assumption and say, actually, I think she will be capable of check raising here with a pretty good range, then you you either shouldn't check the flop or shouldn't bet the river, I think.
Right. I agree with that. Or if I do bet the river, I think I should bet it smaller. So I guess I give myself a little bit less of that feeling of being pot stuck.
I was going to suggest a smaller river bet.
I did end up folding. Spoiler alert. But I did not feel very good about it and had the distinct feeling that I got completely owned.
Yeah.
But obviously she didn't show, so I can't prove it one way or the other. But it does seem to kind of point to the risk you take when you take very exploitive lines and against people where you have no clue whether or not they're capable of counter exploiting you.
I mean, I wouldn't say you have no clue. Like if it's a person.
Oh yeah, I did have a clue.
Yeah, like I mean, I'm pretty comfortable assuming that a relative unknown or someone just known to be like a mid stakes live game rig is not recognizing what a good check raising spot this is. Because I mean, it's also a good spot to check raise for value. Like I think you're extremely likely to bet the river when checked too. If for someone who's good at hand reading, like your hand, like I said, you're going to be comfortable, I think, value betting jacks. And I don't think there's too many lesser, like maybe 10 to check back, but I don't think there's too many like lesser hands in your range. Like once you check the flop and then call the turn, your hand looks like a pretty good one pair that's not going to expect her to check better hands on the river unless she's at a higher level than I tend to assume that the average unknown mid-stakes live game rig is.
Yeah, I mean, especially not to harp on preflop here, but aren't tens pretty likely to just call before the flop? Or I don't know.
I think I would have a decision with tens. I feel I don't think I have really a default in this particular spot for tens exactly. Mm. I think lower pairs, like I think eights and below, I'd probably feel pretty comfortable flatting, and then nines and tens. I feel like I'd go either way with three betting versus flatting.
Okay.
Especially because like with tens, I feel like I could sometimes flat and then maybe have a good back raise opportunity or maybe just set mine. I think the options are a little more wide open.
All right.
But back to the river bet sizing. At the time, I didn't put a whole lot of thought into it. I was just like, oh, what's kind of near half-ish pot? What's a little under half pot? And I think what I probably should have done is think more about the stack size implications, which in tournaments I think is super important, but a lot of people, myself included, often forget to do it, and how much I'll have left if I end up having to fold or if I end up getting called by ace-queen or something. And that I think should have led me to bet smaller. That combined with the great odds I'm getting to call it off to a check raise, if I bet smaller, I'm lessening those odds, and I guess I can, find an easier fold when I'm only getting 2.5 to 1 as opposed to like 3.2 to 1 or something.
Yeah,
and you're losing less the times you have to do that. Like my bigger concern though is just how wide her calling range is going to be when you check. I mean, I think it would be pretty bad on her part to call with pocket nines. That's why I said, when Nate was like, well, maybe she can turn nines into a bluff, I was like, well, I mean, I think that would be better than calling. So I think you kind of have to bet small because the only thing you're looking to get out of her is a crying call if she has some kind of hand reading skill.
Right.
Like you don't have bluffs in your range.
I feel like there are occasional bluffs in my range. I feel like sometimes I might play ace king of clubs this way. I probably end up checking back the river with that.
But I guess I would say you have a very small bluffing range. And that should lead you in game theory terms, that should lead you towards a small bet here because you don't have very many bluffs to balance.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. For whatever it's worth, the more I think about it, the more I like the fold. I mean, I'm not sure you should feel good about it. I mean, I think you're definitely winning sometimes, but probably not a quarter. So I wish I could articulate my reasons for that better, but I do think the fold is correct. I also think you're right that a smaller bet for a lot of reasons would have been better on the river.
I mean, I did tank much longer than I do on most decisions. This is definitely in like the top 2% of tank length for me.
Yeah.
Before I eventually settled on a fold.
Yeah.
Yep. And then a few ends later, I lost a flip, and then that was pretty much that.
Yeah. So much for that good feeling of, or whatever fraction of your disgust was the good feeling of having some chips left to play with. That's
yep.
Yeah, that's how'd that waiting for a better spot turn out?
Waiting for that ace king.
Yeah. All right. So this is just analytical fail on my part, but I have nothing else to say about that hand. Do you?
I think I've said my piece.
Cool. Let's see. I have other hands.
Yeah, let's take one more. We'll try to do it a touch.
All right, one more. This one is from day 1B. I had gotten up to about a little over double starting stack, so 55K in chips by getting aces in versus kings. Always expert skill game move right there.
Excellent. Very good.
So at this point, the blinds are 150, 300 with no ante. Pardon?
No, good move. Expert.
Oh yeah, the aces, kings. Oh, there was also a bunch of dead money in the pot because a dude decided to put in four bets and then call a five bet with the 5-4 of diamonds.
Nice.
And then fold when the guy with king six bet shoved. So that was fun. But that was a fun minimal skill hand by me.
Yeah.
Minimal skill, maximal gain.
Although the skill differential sounds like it was pretty high.
Well, to be fair, that guy, he did. I think that the guy with a 5-4 probably did a very good job later on of using that image and kind of tightening up and shifting gears.
Right.
But that's a little bit too much of a discretion. Discretion. That's the wrong word. Digression. That's the right word. Anyway, so 150, 300. I have about 55K in chips. Joe Tihan, who's a good tournament regular.
Yep.
Opens the hijack to 700. I flat king jack of hearts in the cutoff. The button folds. The small blind, who is the relevant party in this hand. I had played with him actually on day 1A of the event. He's my impressions of him is he's kind of a regular tournament regular who probably thinks I'm playing well and thinking about hand reading and might think I'm on the tighter side. Anyway, this small blind flats and Bernard Lee flats in the big blind.
Okay.
So there's 2,800 in the pot and the flop comes queen 7-6 with one heart. So I have the backdoor straight draw, backdoor flush draw.
Good.
It checks to me and I bet 1,400. For exactly half pot. The small blind calls somewhat quickly. And everybody else folds.
Like the bet.
I think this is a pretty standard bet for me. I have so many backdoors. And I think the main concern in this hand was Joe Tihan.
Yeah.
The opener. And once he checked, I figured I kind of had the green light to steal.
Yeah.
I just felt like this bet would work pretty often.
Yeah.
On this kind of dryish board.
Yep.
Straight
draw, flush draw, king draw, jack draw. That's what you want.
So the turn is the three of hearts. So now I have a flush draw. There's 5,600 in the pot, and the small blind now leads for 2,000. And he started the hand with around, I think, 40K, maybe. Maybe a little less. I cover him, to be certain.
How quickly did he call before the flop?
Before the flop, pretty quickly. It was, yeah. I would say, in rhythm.
All right. I'm going to make the obvious observation that this is entirely consistent with the set at every point, including pre-flop, and not wanting to check raise a four-handed pot on the flop and give away too much strength. I mean, I'm not saying that's the best way to play it, but I do think a lot of people would exactly call, check call, lead out when the heart comes on the turn. Not that that's a huge part of his range, but
okay.
So I'm thinking this looks like a good call to me, just because sets should be a big enough part of his range that I don't want to raise. Maybe that's the wrong way to be thinking. Anyway, what do you think, Andrew?
I think you're going to have a lot of the same bluffing opportunities on the river that you have on the turn. I think like a turn call shows not quite as much strength as a turn raise, but it enables you to represent a wider and more plausible range by bluffing the river if checked to. And I think that you also get, you get the extra information of seeing whether he checks the river. Whereas if he bets again on the river, I think you can be a lot more confident in thinking he doesn't have a hand that he was going to let go of. I think, you know, calling the turn here enables you to represent that you were, represent a range similar actually to what we were discussing in the first hand. It's one of those rare circumstances where you can call the turn and end up with air on the river. I don't think there's a ton of hands in your range that do that. So I think it's a pretty good spot for you to call turn and bluff river or check two. And I think that's going to be a much safer bluffing line than trying to raise the turn now.
I also haven't thought about this completely, but I like the idea of putting some strong draws into your bet flop call turn line, just because it helps you make that set of hands a little more varied and a little bit less terrible and hard to a little bit harder to bluff out. But I haven't had time to think that all the way through.
That's pretty interesting, because I decided to not call. I instead decided to raise to 5,600.
Okay.
And at the time, my reasoning went something like, I kind of thought a bit of the opposite of Nate. In fact, I kind of didn't have much trouble discounting sets from his range. I felt fairly strongly he would lead them or check raise them or do something other than check call with a set and then lead the turn. I just feel like a tournament regular just isn't so much taking that line with a set. I don't know if that's actually empirically true or not. That was certainly my feeling at the time. Who knows if it was motivated by logic or emotions or just the feeling of, oh, I played this guy yesterday, now I'm just going to go on an ego trip and try to bluff him. And also, the other thought I had was that I can represent straights and sets really well if I continue to raise and be more likely to win the pot without improving if I raise now. Because I feel like if I call, if he checks the river, I just don't think my bluff is going to work nearly as often as when I raise the turn and then he checks the river and I bet the river, even though I risk more. I first of all win a bigger pot when I do this, and second of all, I feel like the bluff is just more likely to work.
That's interesting.
Because I still represent sets. I mean, I flatted preflop, 7-6s, certainly my flatting range, 4-5 suited, also my flatting range. And then I bet the flop, which I'm doing with all those hands. And now when I raise the turn, if I call the turn on this kind of drawy flop or a drawy board, I think he can discount those sets and straights and maybe even the like two pairs like 7s and 6s from my range, and then either bluff me. Well, maybe probably not bluffing me when I miss, because King High is probably not the best hand right now on the river anyway when I miss. But he can also bluff catch a little better. And I also don't think he, sorry to keep rambling, but I'm not sure he takes this line so much with the queen. And even if he does, it's not going to be a super good queen that's going to feel very comfortable calling a big river bet.
Okay. Those are all fair things to say. I'm starting to discount sets more than I did before, although maybe this is just me extrapolating from the small sample of tournament hands I've played in my life, I feel like a lot of people I've played with might play a set like that. No, what do you think, Andrew?
I think that if you're comfortable discounting sets from his range, then raising makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. The main reason I was suggesting calling and bluffing the river was because I do think it gives you better information about, like when he checks the river, I think his range is going to be a lot more capped than it is now, or if he checks the river, it's going to be more capped than it is now. And I do think there's, although you're right that the strongest hands in your range would raise the turn, I do think there's a lot of more medium strength hands comparable to the king queen that you had in the first hand that we discussed that would be calling the turn and then value betting the river when checked too. And I was thinking that you could represent those. So I agree that the turn is a better show of strength, and the risks are that you don't yet have a show of weakness from him. Although if you're interpreting his current line as a show of weakness, then that's a different story. And also that, if it turns out he's not actually weak in his hand, is good enough to three bet the turn, then you risk being blown off of your heart draw.
That's also true. I really did not think much about getting three bet on the turn. When I made the raise, it barely, if at all, crossed my mind. Again, I guess it's a rarity thing that you just don't see turns getting three bet that often in general, much less in tournaments. And another thing is about his line is that what really sprung to mind, I thought, was pair plus straight draw. Something like a 6-4 or a 6-5 that now is a gut shot to go with a pair that he decided to peel with. Mm. And is now leading because now he wants to turn to a semi bluff or whatever.
That's interesting. I would expect your average tournament grinder to check a lot of those hands that he peeled with, because like he peeled with a reason, and even if his draw is not the kind of draw that's going to remove any of your six outs, I think a lot of people are in, when I pick up a draw, then I have less to worry about in terms of my opponent's improving mode. So I guess maybe it just depends on how good I think this guy is, but I'm not sure I'd be so likely to think that he would check call lead with a pair that turned a gutter. But
who knows? I expect to see that check call a lot more often.
Yeah. So you raised, and what happens?
And he called pretty quickly.
All right.
In a way that, made me feel kind of like he wasn't trapping, right, and that it was just kind of like, I can't three bet and I can't fold. So, I'm just going to call.
Yeah.
The river, now there's 16.8K in the pot, and the river is the 8 of diamonds.
So what's the board now?
It's queen 7-6, 3-8. And, the flush draw whiffed.
Yeah, I don't see how you can do anything but bomb the river when checked.
Yeah, he checks, and I bomb it. What do you think a good bet size would be for 16.8K?
What are stacks?
I think at this point, I think to start the hand, he probably had maybe 35K, and I covered by quite a bit.
14K?
That's pretty close to what I bet. I've actually bet 12.3K.
Yeah, I was going to guess 12.
I don't know. I mean, you're at this point, you're trying to sell a pretty big hand.
Right. I mean, the thought was that I'm telling the story that I have a set that I have a set of sevens or sixes or four or five. So I'm going to bet this river big and look like I still have it.
Yeah. I mean, my ambitions go so high as to get him to fold top pair. Or I want to bet an amount that could cause him to fold top pair.
I thought 12.3K might be that amount.
Yeah, I definitely think he can fold top pair for 12K. I think that card removal is the only reason he might not fold 7-6. Not all the time, but I think you would have a good shot at folding 7-6 here were it not for card removal. Certainly a hand like 8-9 should fold, but I'm not sure how big a part of his range that is.
I think 8-9. Yeah, I actually consider the possibility of him having 8-9 because maybe he just doesn't want to check raise the field with just the straight draw. Yeah. And now that he's
heads up, with me,
he feels like, okay, now maybe I can, get him to
get this one guy to fold as opposed to getting three people to fold.
Anyway, I like the pretty large bet size, and I do think you have to bet for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, the turn raise makes no sense if you're not going to bum the river.
Yeah, not least of which is that I am not winning this pot with King High, probably.
Yeah, and I mean, that is another small reason, you know, the possibility of 8-9 getting there against you, but being apt to fold is another reason you just have to bet. So, yeah. And
to be honest, I think 8-9 is what he might have had. He tanked for quite a while, probably a good 45 seconds before folding. I guess it's conceivable that he could fold like queen nine or something, but I'm just not sure.
Yeah, I think he could have folded ace queen pretty easily.
I think he's pretty likely to squeeze ace queen pre. Try to play a four way pot out of position.
No, I think that's right, but. I don't know. I feel like we have different ideas of what tournament grinders are. Maybe I'm just stuck in like 2009 or something like that.
I do think, and Leo definitely has more recent experience than I do.
For those of you listening at home, just trust Leo's reads here.
Well, if people at home trusted my reads as much as I do, actually, I don't know how to finish that sentence because often I find that I don't trust my reads as much as perhaps I should. It's very easy to, again, fall into the trap of, well, I was wrong, so that means my reads were wrong, and that means, it's like, it's kind of like a kind of Manichaeism, where if I'm not in, like, the sense of, oh, there are, like, good gods and evil gods fighting for my soul and dictating my actions, but as in, like, there's one pure good in poker, and that's playing perfect all the time, and then everything else that falls short of that, you know, making a mistake, making a misread, is evil and awful and worthy of pillorying myself and so forth. And you know, that's just my mental quirk. I'm one among many in my menagerie of neuroses.
You are tough on yourself. I like how you played this hand.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I would probably call the turn, but especially given that I trust you're being in touch with what the small blind is doing. I think you told a good story here for good reasons, and you got the fold. So,
yeah, nice answer.
Thank you. It felt good at the time too.
Very good, and it kept you. I don't know. It took you almost to the end of the whole day. So yeah, exactly. You know that had to feel great.
And guess what? I lost a flip. I know this doesn't usually happen in tournaments, but
all right. So what's next up? Are you got any big tournaments coming up soon?
That is a good question. I was considering playing the Venetian 2500, but I don't know. I feel weird giving Sheldon Adelson my bucks.
Okay.
But I also have a bunch of good friends who work for the Venetian, so I guess in some way I'm giving them my money too, in a much more attenuated sense. So I'm up in the air about playing that, and I guess there are other more practical concerns as well, like I think it might be a tough field.
Right.
So it might not be worth taking a shot at. But yeah, I guess I have really no plans for tournaments. I have tons of trouble planning more than 2 months in advance.
Well, you've chosen a good profession then. So
absolutely. I mean, ideally I could just keep grinding cash games and hopefully they stay good and I keep playing close to my A game and being profitable in them. I think one problem I have with cash games is that it's a bit of the opposite of, I guess, the culture in which I was raised. I feel like I was raised in like a test culture where you study for something, you pass a test, and you move on to the next thing. And it's been like that in so many aspects of my life, you know, from high school to college to grad school to law school, all of it. It's, you know, just passing the bar. It's you study with this one big test to show that you have the stuff that it takes to succeed, even if you really don't. It's just like a proxy for that.
But then you level up.
And then, yeah, exactly. You keep leveling up. But there is really no good way to do that in cash games. I guess, you know, moving up the stakes would be one way.
Yeah.
But it's just a continuous game with continuous decisions that don't really culminate in a whole lot. I think tournaments are a little different that way, but they're so fraught with variance, obviously, that they mean a little less. I mean, I felt after I won my bracelet, I kind of felt that test mentality creeping in, like, wow, you beat the end boss of poker a little bit. And that's kind of ruinous to a degree, because, you know, in this game, you can just never rest on your laurels. And there's always going to be your competition out there, that some of whom are actively trying to improve and some of whom are not. But the ones who are actively trying to improve, if you don't step up to their level and put in that work, they're going to beat you. They're going to get the edge on you. They're going to exploit. They're going to counter exploit you when you think you're exploiting them. Yeah. And that's just the way it is. There really is no grand test in poker that you can pass to prove your worth, so to speak.
And one day your buzzer finger just won't be fast as the next kid's.
Exactly.
I got some Brazilian food on the way, and I think Leo's beautiful monologue on the terrifying infinitude of cash game poker is a good way to leave our list. Good way to leave our listeners. But really, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Leo. And
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure. Almost as pleasurable as listening to it. No, more so. This one centers on me.
Yeah.
It's like really.
But you still have to really listen to hear what we say about you after you hang up.
Oh no. Yeah. please don't blow up the Wolpertian solipsism.
No, you did great, Leo. Thanks. And previous guests have experienced some run good. Vanessa Selbst won a 5K immediately after being on the podcast. So if you have similar run good, please tell us about it.
I will directly attribute it to you.
That Leo's a hell of a guy.
Yeah, I mean, how many old school MTT wizards are living the life?
Like still doing it?
Yeah, I mean, so he's living in Las Vegas and he's a professional poker player and he plays cash and he plays tournaments. And I mean, Gobble Boy is doing that. I mean, you have your superstars like Jason Mercier and Eugene Kachalov and Vanessa Selbst or whatever, who are flying all over the world and rich and famous and playing everything. Or maybe some of them are $1 million in debt but still flying all over the world. I mean, that's not the point. I mean, not those people. I think those people are in fact all rich, but I'm just saying, besides the people who for whatever reason are living the life where, you know, they're flying halfway around the world three times over the next 3 months, how many people are still living the dream? It's not clear that there are that many. And I think Leo's.
Yeah, well, Shane Schlager comes to mind also.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just another guy who's like, you know, he's not experiencing like catastrophic Vanessa Selbst style success, but you know, he's doing well. He's living a life that he's pretty happy with. He's making, you know, he's making a decent living off of poker.
Yeah.
And you know, just playing and doing all right.
Yeah, I guess I meant to exclude implicitly people who had relocated.
Oh yeah, well, I don't imagine there's too many of those.
Yeah, I mean, just like people who are still in Vegas, like out of all the people who moved to Las Vegas to play poker, like he's still, you know, grinding it out successfully, it sounds like. And kudos to him. I mean, Jimmy Fricky, Gobble Boy, also comes to mind there. But those guys are the exception, and it takes a special kind of person to still be doing it, I think.
Maybe we can get a superfluous mom on the show.
Yes, that would be excellent. I'm sure Leo's mom is awesome. I mean, we should do that, actually. Just get, maybe for like the 25th episode, try to get all the parents who got told by their kids that they were going to be professional poker players. And have them take us through it.
Yeah, my parents have generally been pretty cool about it, so I don't think they'd be the best candidates, but I'm sure we could invite, you know, just put out a general call or something saying, like, we want to talk to, especially maybe parents who have come around, you know, who were initially, like, against it and are kind of like, well, I guess he really made it work. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, or the other way around, people who thought, like, yeah, this is an okay thing to do and now think, like, boy, poker world is fucked up, so...
Yeah, I guess I guess we might have some of those parents as listeners. So, like, I don't know how many people would recommend their parents in that case.
Yeah, that's right. Hypothetically, though, wouldn't that be interesting? So, so what else did Leo say? I mean, I think he's just remarkable for displaying the sorts of habits of mind that are necessary for a poker player. Like, on Twitter, he talks about being a nervous wreck and neurotic, and I wonder how much of that is, like, really necessary for his poker success. I mean, he's just relentlessly self-critical. And
yeah, I've often said he's one of the few people, one of the few poker players I know, professional or otherwise, who is actually better than he thinks he is. 98% of poker players overestimate their skill, and I think Leo is one of the rare ones who underestimate.
Yeah, and I mean, this goes all the way down to individual hands, where, and this is a feature that a few of, like, the really best players I've ever dealt with have exhibited, that they say things like, oh, and I did this, but that's probably wrong, and I did this, and that's probably wrong, where they have, like, the opposite of this confirmation bias, where, like, they just go into a hand analysis assuming that they messed it up.
Yeah.
Maybe it's no coincidence that those people are disproportionately the toughest players around.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like a large number of my students have that tendency, but then I was like, I guess people who are actively looking for poker coaching are pretty heavily self-selected in that group.
No, I think he's got what it takes. I think he's got what it takes. And, you know, we wish him well. Also, podcast effect. We're recording this now after we recorded with Leo the next Bellagio tournament he played. I believe it was the very next one. He got fifth place, final table Bellagio tournament. Same thing Vanessa did, except Vanessa also won it. So that's the official podcast effect. You come on the show.
You need to get to the Bellagio ASAP.
Yeah, that's right. You come on the show, you do an interview with us, you go to the Bellagio, you enter a tournament, bang, final table.
And you've got to get in that tournament before we publish the interview.
Yeah, podcast effect.
You've got a window of 1 to 2 weeks between when we record your interview and when it goes live, and you need to get to the Bellagio in that time.
Podcast effect. Thanks to Leo, and also thanks to Monogold for the music. You can check them out and buy their stuff at monogold.bandcamp.com. And thanks to all our listeners. If you want to help other people find the podcast, please go to iTunes and rate and review us there. Thanks, and have a great week.